Welcome to Neonatology Now, the official podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Here at Neonatology Now, we are shining a light on the real-world experiences of world-renowned experts in perinatal medicine. Together, we will learn from top medical doctors, researchers, and opinion leaders to better understand how we can improve professional neonatal care in Europe and beyond. It's not just about the science. It's about the stories and experiences shaping this critical field of medicine. And now, without further ado, let me introduce you to your host, a seasoned neonatologist and our guide through these fascinating conversations, Professor Mario Rüdiger. Mario, take it away.
Welcome to a new episode of Neonatology Now, the podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Today's topic: long-term development of extremely preterm infants. I'm Professor Rüdiger. My guest for today is Professor Dieter Wolke from Warwick. Yeah, today it's my great pleasure to have Dieter Wolke as a guest. Dieter, welcome to Neonatology Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, we will have about 45 minutes to talk about current data on long-term development of extremely preterm infants. But before we get into details, I would like to briefly introduce my guest, Professor Dr. Dieter Wolke. You are a qualified psychologist and professor of developmental psychology and individual differences at the Department of Psychology in Warwick, England. If I'm right, you worked in London in the 1980s at King's College and Great Ormond Street. And actually in 1990, you started the Bavarian longitudinal study at the Haunack Children's Hospital in Germany. And then came some positions at the University of Hertfordshire in Bristol and 2 years in Zurich. And finally, about 17 years ago, you were offered the current position at the University of Warwick. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. So that's a short introduction from my side. What have I forgotten that is still important to you?
No, it summarizes this quite well, but there's just one correction. Is the Bavarian longitudinal study was started in 1985, and it was actually started by a neonatologist, Klaus Riegel, and the child neurologist, okay, Barbara Ord. And I joined them when the kids were 4 years old to take over for the phase. Of course, okay, I didn't know how long these phases would go. But that's it. So it's important to credit Klaus Riegel, who unfortunately passed away in 2018.
I see. Okay. And one other aspect I didn't ask, it's about the University of Warwick. I know that's a very international university, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I'm 2 years ago, they looked at it. What are the most international universities in the world? And Warwick came out at the fourth most international, with students from 180 different countries. And if you go to graduations, you see all colors and traditions and cultures. So that's quite interesting.
So definitely we have to come to Warwick. But before we start, do you have a special experience in your career that you would like to share with our listeners?
I think one which is quite relevant for neonatology is just how sometimes coincidences or just pot luck of how you get into a particular area. I had a grant from the or fellowship from the German Academic Exchange Service to go for a year to London to study and do a master's course. And when I actually arrived at the University of London, at University College, the professor I was going to work with on memory development and stereotyping, so very cognitive psychology, had left. So I was assigned to a psychobiologist who was a young lecturer, and he was studying babies. And he carted me around London to go to Queen Charlotte's Hospital, West London Hospital, to observe babies. And when I then saw a number of deliveries, which I was introduced to, I just thought, this is what I really want to do. I want to work with babies. I want to do more developmental psychology rather than this cognitive stuff. And that really started it all on, and I've not left it.
That's fascinating. So that is the way you came to the Bavarian longitudinal study, or was there any gap in between?
Yeah, there was a gap in between, because I went to London the first time in 1979, and then I came back to do my diploma. And then I worked from 1982. I worked as a research assistant and then research fellow full-time. And at night and weekends, I was doing my PhD, because in those days, I think sometimes young people don't know how lucky they are that they're now stipends and you can get funded to do your PhD. Hmm. But that didn't exist there. And I think the really most important experience was that I worked at King's College Hospital in 1983 to 1985. I got a fellowship and I worked in the neonatal intensive care unit. So I was okay. Every day in the neonatal unit from the ward rounds all day round. And they thought they had got money from Miss World. The interesting thing was she invited me twice for dinner every year at the Variety Club because I was her sponsored fellow for research of the money she raised. And what we did at that time, I did a lot of research of looking at noise levels, at handling patterns, and so on in neonatal units. And I published a paper, two papers, on environmental neonatologists. So these were one of the first papers showing how much handling, the noise levels, the light levels have an influence on hypoxemia and apnea, and that we should change it. So at the beginning, they thought this was very quirky. But honestly, from the data, at least at King's College at that time, they were persuaded and they changed ward rounds. We didn't look at x-rays anymore in the NICU, but did it outside to reduce the time spent in there, packed handling patterns together. And I also worked with Dräger and Vickers. We were looking at incubators, because when you opened the door, when I measured it, it was 120 decibels. You know, because they hadn't designed them to be noise-free. Of course, nowadays they are. So that got me really into neonatology and preterm children.
That's interesting. So that's interesting stuff, because we in former times, so in the 80s, 90s, neonatology was very invasive, very loud, as you just described. And we are, as neonatologists, were very concerned about it. And we hope if you reduce the noise and if you improve environment, the survival will improve, or quality of survival will improve. But at the end of our podcast, we will hear that there is no change. But let's start with the topic of long-term development.
Okay. Yes. I didn't answer how I got to the Bavarian study. That Klaus Riegel contacted me. I had moved to, and I had given some talks on these babies, and we had also done a follow-up to 2 years of age. And he said, would you write a grant application? We need something new. You know, we have done the big thing of looking at disability and mortality and so on in the whole of the south of Bavaria. But would you write an application? I presented it in July 1990 to, you know, review board, a whole day, and also people from the ministry. And then, to my delight, I was very young then. They said, we give you 13.5 million Deutschmark to run this thing. And so I moved within a month from London to Munich, and everything else is history now. So
yeah, that's very good. So I think we have many young listeners to our podcast. Could you just explain the Bavarian long-term study?
Yes. I mean, it's... It was a study initiated to look at all of the children that were admitted to 17 children's hospitals in the south of Bavaria. So that really ranges from Augsburg in the west to Passau in the east, and of course Munich, Landshut, Regensburg, Deckendorf, all of these places in between Kempten, Garmisch-Partenkirchen. Yeah. So it's quite a large area. And there were altogether 70,600 births in 1985-86 in the 15-month period. And of these, 7,505 children were admitted to a children's hospital, 10.6%. And of these children, there were 682 who were very preterm, below 32 weeks gestation or under 1,500 grams. And we also recruited a control group born at the same time in the same obstetric hospitals of 916 children. And all of these children were followed up neonatally every day, you know, with the index by nurses, then at 5 months, 20 months, and then 4 years, 8 months. Yeah. And that was supposed to be the study. And then I joined and we redesigned it to focus more on the higher risk children, because if we follow everyone up, we have to have short assessments. But the whole idea was for me from the Bavarian study is, which we're going to talk about in general, is that I just thought it's a very naive idea, you know, because neonatologists or epidemiologists, when they do research, you've got the morbidity, you've got gestation and birth weight, and then you have got that data, and then you follow them up 2 years later, 5 years later, 8 year data later, and pretend like nothing happens in between that could alter the developmental trajectory. And that just seems to be naive, and there's a lot of error then in there. So I decided that we look much more on other variables as well, like social variables, you know, not just social class, but parenting, peer relationships, neighborhood, how they get on, you know, also marital relationship and those of the parents, you know, because that can be strong. So we actually widened the assessment, but had to reduce the number of children we could assess because we saw them then for a whole day.
Okay. And that means you received these data not only during neonatal period, but later on as well, these social variables.
Yes. I mean, in particular, later on, we did a lot more of this. We had observation of mother-child interaction. Mm-hmm. We had interviews with the children about self-concept, how they see themselves with peers, with their parents. We did like separation periods, you know, how anxious the children were, in these separation, how they would approach other people, you know, how shy they were. So we looked at a much wider variety of things, which none of these neonatal follow-up studies were doing at that time. Okay. They were focusing mainly on disability, blindness, hearing loss, cerebral palsy, and learning difficulty.
Okay. And by now, you already, or you're conducting the follow-up at 38 years of age, if I'm right. Could you just summarize these findings?
Yeah. So I think very important is that people always look at it as a bottle half full or is it half empty? And most of what I'm going to present or going to talk about is a bit the half empty, you know, how much more risk you have. But actually the bottle for very preterm children under 32 weeks gestation is more than half full. So a lot of these children, more than half of the children, do actually well, are completely in the normal range, have good relationships, etc. So that's a very important thing to put at the front. But then, of course, there is a larger proportion of preterm children who have got difficulties. And the two where you have got really large effect sizes is the first one is in motor development, like cerebral palsy, you know, you have got a rate which is 10 times increased. In developmental coordination disorder, basically what we mean is clumsiness in things in fine motor orientation. And then it is cognitive functioning. You see, the Bavarian longitudinal study and another 10 studies around the world we brought together, like the studies from Lex Doyle or from Dahl or New Zealand and so on, we found that the average IQ difference is about 12 points, still in adulthood, and that's about 0.8 standard deviation. So that's a large effect size. And then we did look very much in our study, in the Bavarian study, to go beyond function, just doing more and more tests, to look at how they master life tasks, you know, like making friends, moving out of the home, earning own money, finding a partner, having children. And what we find already in childhood, and it continues, is that very preterm children on average make fewer friends. They're more than double as likely to get picked on in school, like being bullied, becoming targets of, in Germany would say mobbing, but it's bullying in English. They have got, for example, less experiences of finding a partner. So if I give you an example, the control children were 0.6% who didn't have sexual intercourse by 26 years of age. But in the very preterm group, it was 28%.
Wow.
Much larger. And so what is the question now is, are they less likely to have children? And we're just working on the data. This is not published yet. But what we find is very interesting. In the 20s, there seems to be no difference in of whether they have got children or not. But in the Bavarian study, we already have data at 34 years of age. And what we now find is that it seems to be that very preterm children live faster. So if you can get a partner, you have children earlier.
I see. Okay.
Okay? But when you get to 34 years, they have got significantly less of children because fewer of them partner. Hmm. And full terms catch up and have more children, but they delay it. They have it at a later stage.
Okay.
And there's a theory about it, which is life, it's life course theory, or life history theory, which basically said if you are in danger of getting ill or having higher mortality, and there is still higher mortality also in adulthood you can have, then you live faster. You make sure that you reproduce sooner and then see, you know, to get it out of the way.
Okay. That's interesting. But you mentioned these social factors which have an impact during the life course. So all the data can be predicted just by weight, or are there any factors which have kind of modifying factors?
Yes, and very good that you asked that question, because, I mean, they're actually mediators, which we find. So in the end, it's not any more very preterm births that makes the prediction, yeah? But it is, firstly, we find as prediction at 26 years is if you're female, you're more likely to have children than if you're male. Yeah, it's one thing. The second thing is if you are in a relationship like married or cohabiting, you're 6 times more likely to have children than if you're not.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's an important factor. And the second thing is education and social class. In this particular, their own. So if you have got a lower educational level achieved and you didn't go to university, you're more likely to have children, while those who have got a higher education postpone their reproduction. So what we actually find is that it's much more the social factors that then determine, but they're partly determined by being very preterm, because very preterms have got lower IQ on average, they're less likely to have higher education. So they're earlier finished, they enter the workplace at an earlier time. And those, even though they have got less often partners, those who have a partner then reproduce faster.
Okay. So, but now we know that social factors of children are impacted by parents. And not only in preterms, but in term children as well. So what is the impact of the social environment of the parents?
So to just give you an example, there will be lots of neonatologists listening to it and working in neonatal intensive care. They know what the effect of prematurity is. And I just reported the effect was an IQ difference of about 12 points, being very preterm versus full term. Yeah. But being born, if you have got 3 social classes, in the high social classes, which are those who usually have studied and are in professional, like an engineer, doctor, etc., and so on, to someone who is in the lower, in the working class, who has got basic education, may have done an apprenticeship or not, and so on. Yeah, the difference in IQ we find is about 10 points between the highest and the lowest. So the effect is more or less like delivering a baby very preterm, whether you're in the lottery of life, are born into a family which of lower social class than higher social class.
Okay, and then if you are born preterm to lower social class, that's a kind of addition of risk, isn't it?
Yeah, we looked at it whether very preterms, you know, which you would call a moderation effect, they're particularly affected by it compared to full term. But that's not the case. What we find is an additive effect. So if you're born very preterm, you're 12 points IQ points on average lower, yeah? Mm-hmm. And you're born in the lower social class, you're then 22 IQ points lower than someone who is born very preterm and in the higher social class, yeah?
Wow, Okay.
But on the other hand, if you're born in the lower social class, as a very pre-Terminian, you're in the higher social class, you've got a 10-point IQ difference, you know, so you do better. So in some way, it compensates for some of the difficulties.
So that was my question. So it's compensating. So in the higher social classes, kind of compensating some problems of preterm birth. And is it social class? Is it only money, or is it anything we can have an impact on?
People have looked. I mean, ours was actually, we had an index at the time they had developed for comparing education across countries, and it was really the highest education of the parents. Plus the occupational status, which is the status like whether you're in a management position, or you don't have to manage, you're doing basically handiwork and so on. You know, there was a whole list that you scored it and then you got an index out of it. But if you look at it in general, when people have looked at it, it's not just the money. Because you can have, I mean, I know a friend of mine, he was worked for the tax office, and he was surprised when he went to a garage, you know, which was sort of in the back building, and they turned over $1 million a year for cars and so on. And then you have got a teacher who doesn't turn over $1 million a year. So they might buy the child all sorts of quirky things like an electric-driven car and all of these things, which is not necessarily benefiting their education or their academic achievement because they've got the money. So I would say both things are important, but more important is even the education of the parents. And then secondly, it's also money, because if you live in poverty and you don't know whether you've got enough to eat, whether you get clothes for your children and so on, if you're in really relative poverty, then you don't have time to concentrate on the child because you have to do so many other things. So both things are important. Hmm.
And do you have any idea concerning the mediator? So you have on the one hand social class, and then you have the development, but there must be some kind of mediations. It means how parents interact with a child, or bonding, or these factors which we can have an impact on.
It's a very abstract thing, social class, your occupation and so on. Yeah. And it's a confounder of a lot of different things, because it could be partly genetic as well. But the other parts of this is it your nutrition? You know, you get better nutrition if you're no better in a higher thing. Is it like, for example, that you get more stimulated, it is more parenting and so on? It's presumably all of these different factors. But we looked in specifically, we looked at mother-child interaction in a task which arouses conflicts. You know, you have two buttons. With the one button, so you have vertical lines to draw. With the other button, you had to have horizontal line. And the child and mother had to draw together a house. And the mother got one button, the child got the other. So you have to cooperate.
Okay.
You have to work really well together. By the way, we did this once with nurses and neonatologists. It was the worst interactions we ever observed. So it was here between parent and the children. And so we had like how sensitive the mother was, how controlling she was, how much harmony was. And it was amazing. It predicted academic achievement. We did this at 6 and 8 years and then looked at 13 years at academic achievement. And now we will look at adulthood. We're just working on the analysis. But in childhood, we could see that those in the very preterm group, if you had got very good education, there were about 1.5, were very high sensitivity of the mother. They did about 1.5 times better in odds rate in standard deviation, 1.45 standard deviation on academic tasks than the ones who had really poor interaction. While in the control group, and this was interesting, mother-child interaction made much less of a difference. And so we label control children who are healthy, they're like dandelions. You know, in German you would say Löwenzahn. Yeah, so they're dandelion. You can plant them anywhere. If they have got a bit of water, a bit of sun, they do all right. While very preterm seem to be, towards parenting, much more like orchids. You know, you need the right place, the right temperature, the water. And if you get you have to get this combination right, then they actually benefit and they grow brilliantly.
That's a very good picture. So I will remember this one. Because we as neonatologists have a chance to kind of supporting parent-child interaction or disturbing it during the very first days or weeks of life. And that's a very big issue for us. We have to know how to improve or how to support parent-child interaction very early on.
I think the most important thing very early on is that they have access. So visiting behavior gives confidence, so that you're actually there. And then I think it's very important, like in NIDCAP programs and so on, that they're dedicated people, nurses, because you can't do, you're running around. You need some dedicated people who basically work with the parents to give them the confidence to touch first, to see and to observe. And I think most parents are very intuitive. Only when they're very stressed, you can't see anything anymore. You can't find your key when you're stressed, but when you're calm, you know where it's lying. Yeah. So, and it's the same thing with the interaction.
Okay. But now we come to the question you will have heard very often.
Yeah.
So, because the argument is always these babies, they are 40 years of age now. They come from a very different time of neonatology, because in the 1980s, the neonatology was very different. So our babies are doing much better. What is your argument?
Yeah. Well, that's basically the most frequently asked question when I give a talk. And I said, yeah, but everything is better. Everything is better now, and so on. Look at our survival figures. So it was actually Neil Marlow had started the Epicure study one. And then I joined him for the 6 and 11 year, 19 year assessment, and also Sam Johnson. And so we had the idea, and I said, well, we get all the time this question, because I say everything is getting better. How could we study it? And so applied for money for Epicure 2. So the Epicure 1 were children below 26 weeks gestation. So at that time, they were at the limits of survival. They were extremely preterm. So it was the whole of the UK to get enough of these babies, who survived to study. And then for Epicure 2, survival had improved. They were born in 2006, so 11 years later. And they were all over England, we took them. And then when they were 11 years old, we had a chance to study both of them, both of the groups. So we had studied the first group, and we recently, more recently, studied the 2006 group. And we started comparing. So if everything has got better, then they should do better in the same assessments that we had done. And at both times, we had a control group of the same cohort. They were born at the same time. That's very important, because you have got secular trends. Things change, other things in life change. So we had to have a contemporary cohort, a control group. So let us start. The first publication we had in 2021 in Archives of Disease and Childhood, and we looked at neurodevelopmental outcomes. So is their IQ at 11, and looked at cerebral palsy, blindness, hearing loss. And the title of the article is No Change in Neurodevelopment at 11 Years After Extremely Preterm Birth. What actually happened is that there is not one difference in the percentages of severe impairment. And the IQ of those born in 1995 was 82.7. And of those born in 2006 was 81.4. So there is no statistical difference. So that was for IQ. So the next question was, a lot of the things in neonatology have done. So this is on the background that survival had very clearly improved across 11 years. So the next thing was to look at growth. And there is now better, like using more breast milk, fortified milk. So feeding has become better. And what we actually found is that indeed they did put on weight better. And how long they were, they improved as well. But there was no difference in their head circumference. And that's something which we really want to do because you want to get a bigger volume brain and you want to have a better brain, but there was no change in it. Now, the worry about this fast catch-up growth is, if you think about the Barker hypothesis, which is the hypothesis of prenatal programming, is on the one hand, it could set up things of diabetes, cardiovascular disease, etc. We don't know till we now investigate, which we're doing at 38 years of age. So then we looked at mental health. In the mental health, we looked at questionnaires, which the parent filled in, like, for example, the SDQ strengths and difficult questionnaire about ADHD and about autism symptoms. And we actually found overall a deterioration in the behavior, particularly in ADHD and in ASD, you know, like in autism spectrum disorder.
Okay.
And these are continuous variables. So we have just a paper which will be published. I mean, it's just the revision went in, and I'm sure it will be because it has been preliminary accepted. We looked at diagnosis, and we find that there's no change in diagnosis of mental health disorder either across the time. And then we did the last thing, we looked at recently published, we looked at quality of life, you know, so how parents judge the quality of life of the 11-year-olds. And here we find a clear deterioration. The parents of the more recent cohort do rate their children as having a lower quality of life, and that's in particular because they compare to other children, peers, who are
football. Okay.
And there we find that there is a deterioration, and in particular what they say in their speech and communication and in dexterity, if you look at particular areas of functioning.
But there was no difference in time between the control groups?
In both times, there were differences in the control group. So the extremely preterm did quite a lot worse than the control group in quality of life at time first and the second cohort. But the difference is that relative to the first cohort, to Epicure 2, they have dropped down. They're worse than they used to be in quality of life. So the picture is one that there's really no improvement and quality of life has reduced. And there's another study, which is the Vick studies. They have got three cohorts at 8 years. They looked at them. That's by Lex Doyle and Peter Anderson and Chong in Australia, in Melbourne. And they report exactly the same and even find in cognitive a deterioration compared to controls. Yeah, over time, the difference has become larger in the very or extremely preterm.
Okay. So that's not very promising. But do you have any explanations, especially if you remember your initial work on noise on the NICU and so on? We were very much afraid that this may affect neurodevelopmental impact. And I think we have improved. It's much quieter nowadays on the NICU and the light is better and so on. But if you look at the long-term outcome, there's no effect. So does it make any difference to change the environment or not?
Well, you can do RCTs on that, you know, of current generations, but you're looking actually over time periods. And I think there are two things. So the first thing, we have to see what neonatologists do or obstetricians do to improve survival that are not the same factors that influence quality of survival.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the first thing. So you have to think is that you have got babies that are born immature, and still if you manage to survive, you still have got like a baby at 26 or 27 weeks, let's just take them, they've got a brain that's a quarter of the weight that it will have at full term, a quarter of the weight. So a lot of development now occurs in the neonatal unit with treatment that's being done. And we haven't found anything which is truly neuroprotective or is protective to help that we build a similar brain as if we would be in utero.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens now is when we looked at MRI data at 26 years of age, and there was a recent meta-analysis again from Terry Inder and so on, really confirming and included our data as well, shows that we have got widespread brain alterations. That's in volume, but particularly more on the basal layer, like thalamus in the hippocampal area and so on, in the nucleus acumen. So we find quite on nucleus caudate, there are real differences between which we still see at 26 years of age. And that presumably influences of how they're functioning and how they're processing information. So really, we need something. One is survival. The second thing is to do something which needs to the quality of survival, that we actually sponsor that the brain grows properly, but also the lungs and the kidneys and so on. It's a lot of things. So the second thing is, if you get higher survival, you get more babies that are small that survive. Okay, so you get a higher percentage of the population. If you get that, but you don't change the outcome, you get an absolute number of more babies who have got difficulties. And I think, is it really ethical if we think about that we put a lot of money in neonatology if we not put the same amount of money to support those who are discharged from the neonatal unit? I think ethical thing to do is to give them then the support, like the parents, the preschool, having better education on what special needs they have in school and so on, to actually provide that particular support. But health economic analysis shows that €300,000 goes in for a 26-weeker in the neonatal unit. And then additionally, on average, is about €15,000 or €20,000 spent more on the extremely preterm. That's a complete imbalance. And I think that's something that needs to be discussed. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be neonatology, but it's important that we discuss this and this is open.
That's a very interesting discussion that during the last Hot Topics was a very similar session on this issue, discussing the ethics of giving a lot of money for neonatal care, but not having any other support later on. And I would further agree with you in saying we need, even during neonatal care, we need more money for psychosocial support. I mean, Heidelisa Ahls, she shows how important the interaction of parent and child are in these very early times, like NITCAP or any other projects. Yeah. And I think there's a good chance to start very early on and to prevent some of the long-term consequences in bad child-parent interaction.
I mean, there are some initiatives like, for example, I know in Germany, like Bunter Kreis, to have a better management of discharge into the community, that someone actually helps you, that you have got a case manager who's already in the neonatal unit and takes you on. But it actually goes beyond that. And one of the programs like Sam Johnson here in England has developed is educational material for teachers. And there's now certification that the school is actually preterm certified. You know, that it's a special school that helps preterms who recognize their particular needs, which are often like they're more shy, they're more withdrawn, they have more attention problems, they're not troublemakers, they're more often the forgotten children in the classroom. Yeah, they're more likely to be, because they're shy and not in the in-group and things, they're more often bullied. So there are a number of things which one can do to help them. We now know this from the longitudinal studies. That's why they're so important to say, here is actually something where you could assist.
Mm-hmm. But once again, also during the neonatal time, for instance, the Milgram group, they have shown the sensitivity training of showing parents the signals of the preterm baby, that they can respond to the baby, has an impact not only on MRI, but also on long-term IQ. That's fascinating, to train the parents and to see an effect on the children. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, we actually looked at it. I mean, the one thing is very important to say that the parents of very preterms getting, compared to full terms are not less sensitive. It's just that the that they need, the very preterms are like orchids. They need more than the average child. And therefore, you need to be hypersensitive in a way towards them and towards their needs. And it's really that what we have to support. So it's very important to say that it's not that the parents are insensitive or something. It would be perfectly fine for a full-term child, but they need something special. And in particular, if, I mean, just think about it, and parents tell us so often, it's the stress that they had, in the neonatal unit. I mean, often it's not expected that it's going to happen. I mean, you're worried about whether your child dies. No one can be sensitive. And then the anxiety, can I even touch this little kid? I do remember when I came the first time in the neonatal unit, I could watch them and I went in there, I was surprised. But then I listened to the first ward round. And I have to say, the consultant was Harold Gunzo. He stood next to me and I said, I can see that you're getting pale hearing what was all wrong. And so I said, yeah, I'm not feeling too well. Yeah. And he said, don't worry, every junior doctor has the same problem, you know, so that you suddenly, when you realize and you feel, well, oh God, you have got all of these things, and then you get used to it. And that's it's really stressful. So for parents, it's even hyper stress is their child and to survive. So it's very important to support them. Yeah.
That's very fascinating. So Dieter, what are the next research steps needed to further elucidate the impact of preterm labor on neurodevelopment?
Well, I think, well, one of the things is really that we could do more on interventions.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a very important thing. And there is something, a Nobel Prize winner, Heckman, he has got his intervention curve. So the earlier you do it, the more your return on investment. So that would be important. Obstetricians and neonatologists already do quite a lot of RCTs, but it's quite surprising how few are there after discharge. You know, there are lots of trials on breast milk, not medicine, 45, intonation, nitrogen, all of these trials. But hardly any money is put, and I think it needs neonatologists and others in the medical profession to say, well, we have to put more money for trial units, you know, in different countries towards things which are after the discharge.
Okay.
You know, like in the transition to school, help in preschool, and supporting that. So that's important. And in our studies, in the longitudinal studies, you know, if anyone starts a study now, they cannot do a study not to record the social class, the family conditions, the interaction that these parents have with, and also the wider part of the society, which is actually peer interaction and sibling interaction, to actually know what actually goes on and how we can help. So social development needs to be much more into a focus. So I give you an example. I read recently articles about people, about millionaires or billionaires, when they look back what they could have done differently in their life. And the one thing, and I said, I wish I could live my life again and have more time for my family, have more time actually with friends. And there's a very good saying someone said to me 10 years ago, and I really changed of how I work, is if you don't have time for friends now, you won't have friends when you have got time. Okay?
That's very good. Yeah.
And so the important thing is that actually money can buy you so much happiness. And we have economists at our university who study this a lot. But after a certain level of money, it doesn't increase much the happiness. Mm. You can only have so many cars in your garage and so on. Yeah. But you need enough to live on. But what makes you happy and creates well-being is to have a social network, have good relationships with other people, because we are social beings. And I think we need to focus more on this. And that's what we are doing. You know, do you find a partner? Do you have got friends? Do you have social support when you need it? And so on. And that's an important part for well-being, you know, also positive health, you know, rather than just negative.
That's very important. Okay. That was very fascinating to hear these. And so 45 minutes are over. Oh. And at the end of our talk, one personal question. Do you have any recommendation for students who are at the beginning of their career?
Yeah, you see, my children asked,
okay,
what should I do? How should I go about this? So, and I said to them, you know, first of all, do something which you enjoy. You know, don't be forced in something just for some reason, whether you want to earn more money or your parents or someone who want to force you in something. I mean, take advice, but do something you're interested in, because if you're interested in it, it's so much easier to study. Yeah. Secondly, go to a place that's open-minded. And that's usually often a group of people who are doing research so that you can, that you're not always put down, oh, that's a rubbish idea. We have never done it like this. Everyone does it like this. So that there's an open-mindedness, you know, that you can do things. The third thing is you have to learn that life is full of rejections. And presumably I've learned more from my failures than from my successes, because when I had a failure, I make the paper better if it's rejected. If I've got a grant rejected, I don't argue with it. I say they're good points. I can make it better. And I've learned a lot from this. And the fourth thing is I actually learned you can still be successful if you think in the long term rather than short term. You know, just think, okay, I can publish a lot if I do an experiment. I can do it in 6 months and so on. Because actually, if you do something long term, it might have more impact in the longer term. And I still managed to get highly cited because the longer the study goes on, the higher the value of what you have invested initially in sweat and blood and so on. in the study. And I still enjoy it many years later. And I think that's a gift.
And you need perseverance. That's very important. Okay.
And resilience, you know, with all the
Okay, that was very fascinating. Thank you very much, Dieter. I think we will have in the future another talk, but that was fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was it again. Neonatology Now, the podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Mario Rüdiger on the mic and my guest for today, Dieter Wolke. Thank you for listening. If you do have any questions, do not hesitate to contact us.